Let me remind you again that if you do not have a Faith Angle Forum mug, that they're back there in the back. We want you to be reminded of your time here every time you get up in the morning and have coffee. Okay, we still have a long list. Professor Wacker, you're up first, and then let me just tell you some of you that are coming, because when I tell you, you can be getting the microphone over to yourself before I call on you. Grant Wacker, Phil Rucker, Matt Lewis, Kathleen Caverney, E.J. Dionne, Elizabeth, Ken Woodward, Daniel Lippman, Jamie Weinstein, Miranda Kennedy, Eugene Scott, and everybody else. Okay, Grant Wacker.
It's on, yeah, okay, yeah. May I ask two quick questions?
Of course.
Okay. If you had said no, I'd say I have one question of two parts. All right. Michael asked a big part of my first question, and that is that people who elected to vote for neither candidate, who otherwise might have voted, but found people who found both candidates unfit, all right? And Michael's question referred to evangelicals, and I'm wondering if we can broaden that out beyond evangelicals. We find Catholics and Mormons and non-affiliated coming to that kind of conclusion. That's my first question. And the second one, maybe more for Carlin, is we've talked about the visceral feelings about Hillary Clinton, and I'm wondering if your instruments are precise enough that you could break that down. And what I am thinking about in particular is resentment about her attachment with the intellectual establishment, Yale, New York Times, and before that, Obama and Harvard. So we get Harvard, Yale, New York Times, and so forth. Those are the two questions.
Okay, thank you, Grant. Carl, I'll go second. You go.
Well, with the exception of Mormons, most of the faith communities broken down for survey purposes voted overwhelmingly either for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. So if you look at all Protestants and other Christians, that is to say basically all Christians other than Catholics, you find that 97% of them voted for either the one or the other. So you don't have a big residue left over. If you look at Catholics, 45% overall went for Clinton, 52% for Trump, again 97. So you don't have a huge residue. You do have something significant when you look at the Mormons this year, because Donald Trump got 61% of the Mormon vote versus Mitt Romney's 78%, and 4% of the difference went to Hillary Clinton, but the rest went to Evan McMullen.
With reference to the Mormons, do you find any significant number who simply would not vote because they found both candidates unfit?
Well, there's no evidence that Mormon turnout was down this year relative to previous years, and I think that's because Mormons, first of all, a quarter of them thought that Hillary Clinton was someone they could support, but also the rest who couldn't support either of the major party candidates had some place to go.
Okay.
And they went there.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Then my second question is about the resentment about the intellectual elite.
There's a lot of data throughout the campaign that showed that Hillary Clinton's ties to the establishment certainly did not help her in any way. This wasn't a good year to be an establishment person, and Donald Trump didn't seem like the same kind of establishment that Hillary Clinton did, so
okay.
Very different.
Okay, Phil Rucker. Over here.
Can you hear me? Yeah. So my question is an extension of the discussion we had earlier about white evangelicals voting or believing they can support a candidate who had immoral acts in his personal life for the public duties, and that shift over the last 5 years. And it has to do with Trump's rhetoric and message. And historically, candidates, especially George W. Bush in 2000 and 2004, won over evangelical voters with enthusiasm by having a message and a policy set tailored to those voters. I mean, he talked about traditional marriage, about abortion. Those were things we hardly ever heard Trump talk about. And so my question is, was the enthusiasm of evangelical voters for Trump because of the unique binary choice we had in this election, or is there some broader shift in the way religious voters are viewing candidates where they don't necessarily need to hear policy positions articulated on the stump on those issues, but you know, are looking more to economic themes or foreign policy themes or leadership qualities or so forth?
Yes, Carl?
I think the court was for Trump what abortion and the other issues had been for George W. Bush. I think it was just so important to them overall. One other thing to say about the siege or the threat mentality, I mean, it's been going on for a long time for these voters. What was the Post headline so many years ago? Poor, uneducated, easy to command. Easy to command, yeah. I mean, this has been building for a very long time, and I think that contributes to the answer to Sally's question that with the court and with the fact that this has gone on so long and with very negative feelings about the media, which we haven't talked about yet, those things combined to push these voters solidly to Trump.
So. I agree with all of that. I would put one back up a step. We're going to be looking at this issue for a long time, because the data that we have suffice to put the question on the table, but not really to answer it. And I think the answer will have to be in part quantitative with some good follow-up work, but in part qualitative and perhaps even participant observer, you know, a conversation that Pete started for us. But let me just share with you a sense that I can't prove. And that is that a lot of people in this community felt not only embattled, but also silenced. Right? That much of what they'd come to believe was no longer respectable to say publicly. And here, you know, so here's someone who comes along and breaks every convention of public discourse. And I have to believe that it amounted to a kind of joyous desublimation for lots of people. You know, and this is not to defend it, but it is to explain it. I mean, if someone says something out loud that you don't dare to, but you can say to yourself, damn right, and you can look at your, you know, you can look at your buddy and say, damn right, it's about time someone said that, that is a profound, not only is that personally gratifying, but it creates a visceral connection between you and the person who said the thing that you nod and say damn right to. And so, you know, and I think this whole question of the boundaries of publicly permissible speech is one that deserves further inquiry, because if you look at it, a majority of Americans believe, in a couple of surveys I've seen, that the constriction of public discourse has gotten to a point where it's genuinely a problem. That's not necessarily my position when you get down to details, but you'll find 55 or 60% of Americans assenting to that position. We have to pay attention to that.
Yeah. Carl,
two survey organizations in the last month, the big UVA poll on culture and a PRI survey asked about political correctness, and you could tell the public's pushback. You had roughly 60, I think, percent of both of them saying that, you know, this has gone too far. So.
And let me just add, Philip used the word evangelical enthusiasm for Trump. I think that word is too strong. I mean, I don't know what Pete's anecdote to tell him, but again, the evangelicals that I voted for Trump were very, very reluctant. It was not easy. You take, for example, a leading evangelical magazine with a wide circulation, World Magazine, extremely ambivalent about Trump. And then all of a sudden, when the audio came out about Trump's conversations out in Hollywood, they did a major cover story saying Trump should step down and get out of the race. Now, they got cream for it, but But a lot of readers wrote in and said, thank you for being courageous and telling the guy to just get out of the race. So there's still a lot more to be done about the word enthusiasm. Deep reluctance probably would be a better use of the word.
Anyway. Well, I think this is an interesting question,
yeah,
Michael, because a couple of surveys that I saw suggested that the community was split almost down the middle between the enthusiasm group and the reluctance group. And I can well believe that the thought leaders in the evangelical community were more reserved in their support for Trump than the rank and file. There may be a real gap there that we should pay attention to.
Yeah, oh, that's very helpful. Matt Lewis, you're up next, and then Kathleen.
Just to follow up on what Philip asked, I think this was along the lines of something he raised. So I think it's very obvious to all of us, even though the data doesn't necessarily prove this, it seems very obvious that a lot of the reason for the shift has to do with people reverse engineering justification for voting for Trump. So that seems pretty obvious. But there's the other possibility as well, which would say that maybe Americans and religious Americans and white evangelicals are organically becoming less concerned about the personal morality of their elected officials. I don't know if there's any way to, I suspect the truth is a combination. A lot of it was hypocrisy or, you know, ex post facto justification of voting for Trump. But I also think that even religious Americans are becoming more tolerant, less devout. And I'm not sure which, I guess the question I would have, and it would be purely speculative, would be like which is more concerning, actually? is it hypocrisy or is it a legitimate organic shift?
Rabbi, right. Well, look, organic shifts, to quote you, tend to happen relatively slowly and tectonically. The movement from 30% to 72% among white evangelicals in the space of 5 years is not an organic shift. It's the tectonic plates that were seized up shifting dramatically, producing an earthquake and a new configuration of the landscape. But the broader question of whether Americans are driving a broader wedge between the private conduct and the public person, I think, is well worth asking. I have to say that the more we find out about the private conduct of past presidents whom we rightly admire, the more we have to think about in that dimension. Franklin Roosevelt cannot be reduced to Lucy Mercer. JFK can't be reduced to Fiddle and Faddle. To be blunt and just to state my personal point of view, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that in fact private virtue and public virtue are not exactly the same thing. Now, if you get really radical along those dimensions, you end up with Machiavelli praising Hannibal for his cruelty and infinite other virtues. That's a quote, right? But still, I think it is too easy by half to assume that those two sets of virtues are simply isomorphic when there's so much evidence that they aren't.
I agree with that, and I would also say that the sort of rise in non-judgmentalism that you see in the polls starting in that Gallup battery that they began asking in 2000, maybe extending to other kinds of things, and this could be one of them. So,
okay, Kathleen, over here, pull the mic.
Can you hear me now?
He'll turn you on.
I guess I have one question on the public-private split.
And I'm really questioning whether that's the way to think about that, religion in the private realm versus politics. If you go back to the founding of this country, especially by, you know, religiously inspired people, the Puritans, and what you saw was a community that was seen holistically as both religiously motivated and politically ordered to do justice to God's you know, favored way of organizing a society. And if you look at the sermons in that time, you had a lot of, maybe it's not rigging or reverse engineering as much as it's reflective equilibrium. So when you had King Charles in charge over in England, who had too many Catholic sympathies, you saw the Puritans referring more to the Book of Judges for their inspiration for political life, not to the kingship. When you had William and Mary come in later on, you see all of a sudden we're referring way more to the biblical verses that talk about the importance of having a strong and mighty king. So the people draw from scripture, inspiration, but they also draw from politics. And this has been as long as the country's been around, you know, attention to different verses and different passages and different ways of organizing themselves in scripture. So maybe we need to start, at least for these religious groups, evangelical Protestants and Roman Catholics, not with a sense that these two spheres are separate, but for the sense that they're in some messy way integrally related. So that would be the first question. And where I've seen in the Trump thing is I see a lot of references, you know, maybe not a lot, but enough references to Cyrus of Persia, that, you know, he's not a believer, but he could be sort of a messiah from the outside who's going to save the religious community as an instrument of God. So that's the first question. The second, the question that follows from that is part of the problem on the political correctness thing, you know, for evangelicals and Catholics, the sense that progressives were pushing too far and too fast. And where I see this was, you know, you just got Obergefell, putting in place same-sex marriage. And then the next thing you know, we're right on the train to full transgender acceptance and the sense that, you know, gender fluidity is something that we have to accept. We have to call everyone by the gender they say they want to be called. That's another big step. And you could argue that the country was not even given a moment to breathe and absorb the big step of Obergefell before you're moving on to, you know, transgendered issues. And I think that in religious communities, and I wonder what the data shows about this, says, well, there's never going to be enough. We're never going to be able to be at a resting point. It's going to be one thing after another thing after another thing, so we have to stop it now before it, it all goes, you know, apocalyptic, which is another very big strand, as someone pointed out, in American thought. So I just wondered on those two questions, transgender and maybe religion and politics aren't separate and are being mixed, but they were always together.
Well, first of all, to say that private virtue and public virtue are not isomorphic is not at all to say that religion and politics aren't integrally related.
I guess I'm going back to the early, way, way early question. So not much private virtue and public virtue, but more the question you and EJ had, are we studying religion and politics, or are we studying politics and religion?
Well, you know, you used the Rawlsian phrase reflective equilibrium. Political theorist in me recognizes mm-hmm. that. And, you know, and that is, you know, that's one way of looking at it, but this strikes me as sort of unreflective disequilibrium, to be honest with you. Okay. It's not clear to me that this represents a stable point of equipoise so much as a reaction formation, at least what we're now talking about. But yes, I would certainly hope that anybody who absolutizes a principle of conduct, whether in private life or in public life, will eventually, through experience, be brought up against an example that really challenges whether there is that kind of bright line between
actions that are thinkable and actions that should be regarded as unthinkable when there are circumstances in which the unthinkable has to become thinkable in order for moral integrity to be preserved. That's a profession of faith you just heard out of me. Now, with regard to the second point, the second point about the pace of change, I think that's very important. And I have long believed that societies have absorptive capacities which they exceed at their peril. It's not just the direction of change, but also the pace of change that tells us whether we're on a sustainable course. Speaking personally and politically, I think I agree with the thrust of your second question. I think that the pedal was put to the metal, the pace was forced. My understanding is that the shock of Obergefell in the evangelical community was profound. There are many, by the way, many of my friends who are advocates of same-sex marriage were opposed to what they called the Roe strategy,
yeah,
and were much more comfortable with a state-by-state approach. And I have a lot of sympathy for that, frankly. And they were afraid that it represented an overreach which would create a counter-reaction. I don't think that's happened with the specific issue, but it certainly contributed to the more global sense of overreach that I think you rightly attribute to many members of the evangelical community. And to put it as bluntly as possible, I think that the transgender bathroom letter was a mistake in every conceivable respect, and I cannot imagine who thought of that caper. I can't defend it, period.
Would you elaborate? Can you elaborate?
Well, yeah. I think it's very, I think it's very simple.
I knew you'd say that.
Every sustainable social advance rests on an either nascent consensus or emerging consensus.
Right.
And if you look at the same-sex marriage issue, and Carlin may have a different view, I have never seen public opinion on a fundamental social question change as fast as it did on that issue. By the time the Supreme Court made its decision, it wasn't a leading indicator, it was a trailing indicator. It wasn't anything like Brown, right? It was a ratification of what more than 60% of the American people regarded as a done deal. And if you looked at people under the age of 40, they couldn't even understand why there was a question. So, but what happened with that letter was of a completely different order. It put an issue that was unfamiliar to most Americans outside a very small circle of advocates, one for which public opinion hadn't been prepared anyway, and it said, this is what you have to do. So setting aside the substance of it, to act on that kind of emotional issue with no public political preparation at all is just on its own terms a political mistake. And then we can have a long debate about some of the deeper questions. So that's my position. And my name is about to be mud if this is being tweeted out, but my name is mud in so many communities already that I've stopped caring.
I agree completely with what Bill said on the second question, but I can't prove it from the data. There are no questions that really ask about whether you think things are moving too fast. And if there were, I have a feeling people would say yes.
Okay, E.J. Dionne and then Elizabeth.
First, my apologies for being late. I had an 8:30 call that went on longer than I thought. Second, thank you, Mike, for putting together a great session, which is another way of saying thank you for inviting some of my favorite people. I never expected to be thinking of Cyrus of Persia in light of this election. Third point, thank you for Bill for introducing the term joyous desublimation, which sounds like a high-end reference to an orgy. And last, I salute Matt Lewis for already posting something on this session. As Bill alluded, I'd like to ask both the panelists and the group to help me resolve an argument I'm having with myself, which is that there's part of me that thinks this is the most godless, religionless election we have had in a long time. Just to add one data point, I looked at the Catholic vote, and white Catholics voted almost identically to all white people, and Latino Catholics voted almost identically to all Latinos. That is to say, race and ethnicity seem to be far more important than anything else in determining their votes. And for all the reasons described about what it meant for evangelicals to support Trump, not only to support Trump, which is not surprising, but by larger margins than they supported George W. Bush, for example, you know, is sort of hard to put your head around. Now, that's sort of my sort of number one position, but there is a backup reply to that position, which, you know, Kathy and you, Bill, and others have alluded to, that if you talk to conservative evangelicals, they would say, you know, A, the Supreme Court, which is, covers a lot of issues, B, I have run into fear of, if you will, liberal statist overreach. You know, one example you heard a lot from conservative religious people is Christian universities losing their ability to get student loans because of their stand on gay marriage. So there were clearly some issues in the minds of these voters that pushed him in this election. And as Pete suggested, there is also the fascinating theological issue of Hillary Clinton as a demonic figure, or worse than a demonic figure. I'm just curious if you could sort of talk about these two alternatives, because in some ways, this election, again, Bill alluded to this at the beginning, maybe just returning to where we were a long time ago. White evangelical voters started shifting Republican back in 1964. The issue clearly was race and civil rights then. There was an interruption in 1976 because Jimmy Carter was a white Southern evangelical, and then it shifted right back by 1980 to where it had long been since 1964. I'm still inclined to view number one, but there are at least some bits of evidence you can cite for view number two. And I'm curious, I guess in a way I want to press you, Bill. You raised this question. I'd like to know more about your answer. And I'm very curious how Carlin looks at the figures too. Thank you.
I have sympathy with view number one, that the patterns in many ways were strikingly familiar, with the possible exception of the Supreme Court. So I think that's where I'd come down, view number one.
Well, Bill, I also address this point, which is under there too, is that Hillary Clinton did not have a religious liaison, as we could, as much as we could tell in this election, that she had in 2008. There didn't seem to be any attempt on the Clinton campaign to reach out to religious voters.
Or just to add to the point, to emphasize her own religious character, except at certain moments of the campaign. I thought her South Carolina victory speech was one of her best speeches. And it was also one where her religious side really emerged. And a friend told me that's partly because she spent so much time in African-American churches. And I was also told that some in the campaign were uncomfortable with how that very religious Hillary Clinton.
Well, first of all, to your point, you know, as you know, I agree emphatically, but my agreement is much less important than Michael Ware's agreement. Because he is a, you know, sort of a leading Democratic liaison to faith communities, and particularly evangelicals. And I've talked to him since the election, and he's really beside himself at the total failure of the Hillary Clinton campaign to reach out in any way. That's one of many sort of self-narrowing, nasty surprises that that the retrospectives are turning up. And you know, there's other anecdotal evidence from the campaign to the effect that they were very, very brusque about dismissing certain classes of voters as, quote, not our targets, forgetting about the fact that you don't have to win majorities. All you need to do is narrow the other side's majority in order to get what you want. And you know, and if you don't talk to people, groups, a majority of whom will give their votes to the other side, and you know that, then that majority is bound to increase and bite you. And if I were asked to give a a summary explanation of what happened in the upper Midwest, that failure to reach out beyond the self-anointed coalition would be high on the list. But now let me return to EJ's point. I suspect that a lot of evangelicals believe that Donald Trump was the godless instrument of God's purpose. Betcha. And you know, and this is where now Cyrus had many virtues that Donald Trump lacks and lacked many vices that Donald Trump has. So I don't mean to equate them in any way, but certainly, you know, my people way back when got back to Jerusalem because of Cyrus, so I'm not going to complain about Cyrus. I don't care what he believed.
Make Israel great again.
Absolutely. That would take some doing, although greater Israel may be in the offing. No, right. but I do, and here's another datum. A reporter, perhaps someone in this room, reported that Donald Trump gave the first victory speech by a newly elected president in at least 30 years that did not mention the word God. He left that to Mike Pence. So that would be further evidence in favor of the godlessness of the election on both sides. But that, I think, is consistent with the proposition that people who voted were at least some of them were animated by fears rooted in a religious outlook. I mean, you and I have, over the years, have both discussed the impact of the Affordable Care Act and the contraceptive mandate in shaping attitudes and in creating a kind of paradigm of coercion that crystallized the fears of conservative religious communities that public norms would force them to change the internal norms of their communities in ways that they found unthinkable. And by the way, in the early 1980s, the Supreme Court handed down a case, the Bob Jones case, which I think was correctly decided, but which raises some very important questions about the relationship between public norms and tax-exempt status. And when the Solicitor General gave the fateful answer that he did, I think what he was doing was echoing settled Supreme Court doctrine, but in a politically explosive context. He wasn't making that up. If the Supreme Court followed precedent and reasoned consistently from that precedent, then if a public norm becomes as entrenched as the anti-racism norm becomes in our public law, then it is a basis for the withdrawal of tax exemptions. So these fears are not groundless. You can see a process that would lead from where we are now to the evangelical nightmare, and more generally the conservative religious community nightmare. And you know, and so that if you'll permit me just a more theoretical note here, if you take deep moral and religious pluralism seriously as the organizing principle of subcommunities within the United States, then you have to recognize some limits to the reach of public norms. That's what taking pluralism seriously means. And then the question is, where is the line to be drawn? But the idea that you can have universal public norms and robust pluralism of morality and religion at the subcommunity level is simply not possible. Right? There has to be, if you're going to have any private and communal sphere at all, there must be a limit to the reach of public norms.
Could I just ask a quick follow-up, which
Please.
Is, I think that's broadly right, except that we renegotiate those boundaries
Absolutely.
All the time. And so The difficulty right now is that we are in the middle of an elaborate renegotiation of those boundaries, which is creating a lot of political static.
There's no question about that, but this renegotiation is not going to be a linear process. There's going to be a lot of pushback, and there's no guarantee that, for example, where the line was drawn in the Obama administration on the contraceptive mandate is where the line is going to end up in a year or two. I rather suspect it won't.
If we have Obamacare at all.
Right. And if we don't, a pushback from conservative faith communities will be a big part of the reason why, I believe.
Anything to add, Carl? Okay. Elizabeth, you're next, and then Ken, you're after Elizabeth.
Mike, and thank you to the panel. And I just wanted to thank everyone at this roundtable and the friends and supporters who are here. I've been looking forward to being able to have this kind of conversation after many months of trying to examine lots of these things just on our own. So thank you to all of you. And I really appreciated the question, you know, when we're studying religion and politics, what exactly is it that we're studying? So jumping off of points made by EJ, Phil, Sally, and others, it seems like the data that you all have presented this morning really suggests religion isn't as strong as things like whiteness, how people marry, how people have and raise children. And so, you know, all of those things are also tied up in the formation of religious identity. It, you know, religion is not just a philosophical system to which people ascribe and draw things for their morals and ethics from. It's the set of all these intersectional forces, cultural, economic, racial, gender, all things that keep people in a tribe, that form the tribe in a certain way. So when it comes to the issues of the election, like abortion, religious liberty, I'm wondering more how those are coming from a religious place, like meaning more the philosophical side of religion versus all these other factors, which, as we're saying today, seem to have reached a new boiling point and at least a new outcome, or raising different issues in the election, or at least we're being more aware of their influence. So is there good polling statistics analysis that you would point to on how those intersectional factors are shaping what we've called the faithful electorate and how they have changed over time in shaping Christian America?
Polls are such a blunt instrument. There are just so many things they can't tell you, and they can't, and also they can't even get it right sometimes. But I think if you look at the work of John Green and some of the others who've really dug into these data, you might be able to learn a little bit more about your broader question. But we certainly relearned in this election, if we hadn't learned it before, that party is enormously powerful in elections, and it seemed to trump a lot of other of things overall. We expected a surge of women to Hillary. That didn't happen. Party was more important. We expected, you know, a lot of different things like that, where religion certainly wasn't the dominant variable overall, that a lot of other things, I think, trumped it. I'm not sure I'm getting to your question, but that's as close as I can get. And the data are so blunt in so many ways, so crude, that it's really very hard to understand some of these deeper questions.
I absolutely agree with that. I would just underscore, Elizabeth, one word that you used in your question that I think we need to think harder about. That word is tribe.
Tribe, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I really, I am really struck relative to my youth. I'm struck by the tribalization, or maybe the re-tribalization, of America. Political parties have become tribes, mm-hmm, in important respects. And I think we're wrestling with this question of how to do the nation's business in the midst of this re-tribalization. I was at a meeting just a few days ago with former Prime Minister Tony Blair, you know, who's rethinking a lot of things that he was very sure about 15 years ago. And one of them is the idea of the relationship between pluralism, heterogeneity on the one hand, and what he called the common space on the other. I think we're going to have to work a lot harder to restore the basic framework of and the principles of the common space in order to be able to deal at all effectively with this strong tribal impulse that we see at work in America. And and people at various points along the political spectrum, I think, have to do some rethinking about the ways in which they have contributed to these tribal sentiments at the expense of the common space. And one area where I've been particularly active for a long time is in the area of civic education, which is conspicuous by its neglect throughout our educational system and more broadly. That's another 50-minute lecture from a former college professor that I will not inflict on you. But, but there is a lot of complicity on the part of a lot of institutions in the dramatic weakening of the idea and the practice of the common space, and I think we have to work a lot harder to restore it. We're going to be in even bigger trouble than we already are.
Thank you, Bill. Ken Woodward?
Yes, two comments and a question. First comment is...
Pull the microphone over, please, Ken, and turn it on.
Is it on? Can you hear it?
You got to push the button.
It's on. I can hear it. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Quick comment. Kathleen was talking about, what she was talking about was coined by Don King, rapidation. Things changing so fast that people pull back. And he probably coined it in the 70s as things were spilling out of the 60s. But I certainly agree that feeling is there. I mean, I certainly have it myself. The other thing I wanted to mention was that we talked a while back about the millennials not relating to institutions. And what I find interesting is the research that's being done that would indicate that the young, including the children of people who are here, have an instrumental relationship to institutions like high school and particularly college, and also to jobs. Talk about rapidation. I should be in a job 5 years and I should be moving on in 5 years. The anticipation of that sort of reminds me of the talk about the family in the past. This marriage, this marriage will be a starter marriage because I know there's another one coming a few years down the line. It's that attitude that nothing is stable, and certainly institutions aren't. And it seems to me that this the whole business of preparing yourself for a resume to get into college, which kids learn very young. I think the instrumental relationship to institutions, things that are to be used. The only one that isn't instrumentalized is the family, and they're the most. That's the institution the young people today are most dependent on for whatever progress they make. Okay, so I would take that conditioning all the way back, and I would call it part of the social script that belongs to the young today. The other question I wanted to ask, I was very interested that we have the data and all of that sort of thing, and then some of the richest comments were comments, anecdotal comments that we have been making, which raises a question for me. I have always had a real problem of listening to conversations and participating in conversations that talk about the evangelical vote, the Catholic vote, and so forth. If you look at one of the more recent maps of American religion, you'll see that it is, well, I'll be passing one around later, that Massachusetts, for example, is Catholic red as opposed to Baptist blue or whatever. And yet only 17% of Catholics bother to go to church in Massachusetts. There are such degrees of belief, behavior, and belonging that people who identify, except with what's going on with the nuns, I don't see that your instruments, other than asking a question about how often do you go to weekend services, can really get at the range, I think, of people who identify but don't have it close to the center of their lives. And I think that, therefore, what Peter Wenner said early on, all these other range of reasons why, in this case, evangelicals voted, really had nothing to do with religion. So my skepticism continues about how worthy these categories, evangelical, Catholic, and so forth, are.
Yeah, that was a question.
Well, do you, other than asking how often they go to church, can you measure anything that would get at, yes, I'm Catholic, but yes, I'm evangelical, but
I got it. That's good. I mean, when people said evangelicals voted for Trump in South Carolina, my understanding was that an evangelical is somebody who went to church at Christmas and Easter. That doesn't work. Bill, Carlin, take a stab at Ken's
question. Well, I think Carlin is much better equipped to deal with the survey question than I am.
Okay. Let me just say a word about the millennials and their instrumental attachment to institutions. I'm not sure these numbers are absolutely correct, but I think people in my generation, when we were 18 to 24, expected to have 3 jobs, and millennials now expect to have 13 over the course of their lifetime. That's an extraordinary change in your relationship to your job, and everything else is changing because of that experience, I think, overall. So the social script, as you called it, is I think, makes them think differently about their attachments to institution than perhaps other generations. So I think that's very well taken. And as to getting at more, I think several pollsters are trying to do more, particularly PRRI, from a liberal progressive perspective.
Let's for the record say who PRI is.
I'm sorry, Public Religion Research Institute in Washington, headed by Robbie Jones, that does a lot of polling with Brookings overall. I think they're trying to get to some of these deeper questions, but very few polling outfits have the money to do this kind of work, and so what we get are these top lines that don't tell us mm-hmm. very much over mm-hmm. a long period of time, other than in the basic categories.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to Carlin's response on the polling question, I think, is one that I have nothing to add to. On the previous point, on the first point that you made, I would add a couple of qualifications. Qualification number one, millennials don't believe in institutions that other people have constructed, but they are very good indeed. They are driven to form networks of attachments of their own. And I have noticed, for example, my son is 32, so he certainly qualifies as a millennial. He keeps up with friends from different stages of his life in ways that I never dreamed of doing, right? They really do form network communities that they take very, very seriously. And whether that will translate down the road into parallel developments in the area of religion strikes me as a very interesting question. I can only pose the question. I have no data to answer it. But my guess is that there may be groups of millennials who come together for religious purposes outside the framework of a church or a synagogue or down the road a mosque, but which have a more than passing relationship to the moral and doctrinal questions that traditional religions pose. Can't prove that. With regard to the jobs issue, I don't think it's that millennials have instrumentalized jobs. It's that jobs have instrumentalized the workforce. And if you have in the space of 40 or 50 years, you know, employers who have shifted from, in effect, lifetime employment of people who walk in the gates at the age of 18 or 19 or 20 to one where the workforce is seen as an instrumental cost center to be minimized, well, I think it's only reasonable for people to adjust their sense of the appropriate relationship to a job. It's just realistic.
You know, to go into a job at the age of 23 these days with the assumption that you're going to be there for 30 years is preposterous, right? And you're going to end up, you're going to end up in a very bad place if you think of your first or second or even third job in that light. And so I would defend the millennials on this.
So it's a reasonable reaction to the situation, the job situation in which they find themselves.
That's what I think.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Daniel Lippman and then Jamie Weinstein. And then Miranda.
My first question might be, what would you suggest Democrats do to lessen the concern that, you know, a lot of religious Americans have about the party, and they think that, you know, they're trying to stop them from believing and saying what they want? And also my second question might be, do you expect evangelicals and other religious Americans who had supported Trump over the election to, you know, notwithstanding his personal shortcomings, if he continues with, you know, as president, saying some of the things that he's doing in the transition, are they going to continue to cut him a break, or would you see their support lessening over time as they see him, you know, as president?
Okay, as the Democrat on the panel here, you might want to take that. Advice for Democrats on religion.
Yeah, spend more time talking to people you don't agree with. And this is good, you know, this is probably the wrong occasion for me to offer advice to my party, which is invariably ignored anyway. You have to begin.
This is the perfect occasion.
You have to begin with some humility. You have to begin by listening to people that you don't agree with. And by the way, listening to people you don't agree with doesn't mean that you're going to come to agree with them or them with you, but it is a sign of respect. And then just to build on something that I said previously, if you run a presidential campaign and you don't even try to make your case to a wide swath of the population, they will draw the conclusion that you don't particularly want their vote. I mean, there's a famous Tip O'Neill story that I bet a lot of people in the room have heard, to the effect that he was campaigning for re-election, and after the election, he walked up to this Irish grandmother and said, "Well, thank you, Mrs. McGillicuddy," or whatever her name was, "for supporting me and voting for me." And she looked him in the eye and said, "Well, Tip, I didn't vote for you." He was stunned. "Why didn't you vote for me?" Her response, "Because you didn't ask." So, get the conversation started. No guarantee how it's going to work out. But if you don't have the conversation, it is bound, the situation is bound to persist. Very simple.
Anything to add, Carl? Advice for Democrats?
No, not for Democrats or Republicans. But I think to the second question, like all Americans, evangelicals' judgments are going to be performance-based. They always are. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay. Jamie Weinstein, over here.
There was some discussion earlier about why evangelicals voted for Trump and the numbers that they did, and it does seem reasonable, some of the theories, the Supreme Court, for instance, as a pick. It seems less reasonable if a significant number of evangelicals, a majority of evangelicals, pick Trump as their first, second, or third choice in the Republican primary. And I guess my question is there a data set of what percentage of evangelicals had Trump as 1, 2, 3, or 4 in the Republican primary? And if a majority had him in that position, does that change our understanding of why evangelicals actually supported Trump? I guess those theories about the Supreme Court being primary would no longer be sufficient.
That's a darn good question.
That's a great question.
And we do know some things. My understanding is that, you know, that Trump carried the evangelical vote in about twice as many states as it went for Ted Cruz. I think even, Carlin, didn't you mention the number previously? 17 to 8 or something?
Right, 19 to 27.
19 out of 27. Okay, so there's a datum. Secondly, from very early in the campaign, if you look at Ted Cruz's theory of the case, it depended on a dominant position among evangelicals. From the very beginning of the race, he did not get that dominant position. I think he was shocked. Lots of other people were shocked, but even early on, Donald Trump, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong, but I have the impression that almost from the beginning, Trump made surprising inroads into the evangelical vote in Republican primaries. Would that be an accurate summary?
Yeah, that's right. And then that was when he was supposed to get the lead that he thought he would never relinquish.
This he being Cruz.
Yeah, that was the assumption of the Cruz campaign. And what was interesting was Cruz made the appeal to evangelicals on the old model. Mm-hmm. When in previous elections one would have assumed that that would have had a lock on them. And it was really, I think, Trump that changed the paradigm. Either evangelicals changed from the past, that is that their own criteria of what they wanted a candidate changed and Trump filled it, or that Trump himself embodied something that caused them to change. But I think, Jamie, I think that 19 out of 27 is the closest data point that there is, which is significant.
Repeat what the 19 out of 19, hold it, Sally. The 19 out of 27 data point is what again?
That's
how many Trump won. Of the Republican
primaries. Yeah, I think the new model would have been Trump's form of engagement. I think what Bill said was quite right, which is a sense of a kind of pervasive political correctness. And that they viewed Trump as someone who just broke it apart, and there was some sense in which they said, as you were quoting, sort of damn right. And so, rather than the usual kind of issue set that you would say, which the usual you know, semantics that evangelicals use, he brought something else. And what they heard in Trump, whether one agrees or not, they just seemed to associate. It, and there was an affinity to it, and it was just different in my experience than anything else. And I don't think that that you can break it down to policies per se, certainly not to religious experience like it was with George W. Bush when he was said in the 2000 election, you know, Jesus was my favorite philosopher. That created a kind of instant connection with a lot of evangelicals. They had a connection, a lot of them, with Trump, but it was for something that was entirely different. And I do think that a lot of it, is largely anecdotal, but I think it's also somewhat research-based as well, which was a sense of him being a vehicle for a lot of frustration and anger and under siege. And he was unafraid to take on the very kind of elite figures that they felt had been dishonoring them and disrespecting. And he not only took them on, but he refused to back up. And so I think that, again, this is impressionistic, but there was some kind of deep, visceral attachment with him that was different than everything that had come before.
So basically he had the right enemies.
I think the right enemies and also in their eyes, or the eyes of a lot of them, the right approach. They viewed him as strong and courageous and someone that was willing, not only that he had the right enemies, but he was willing to stand up to them and that he was unafraid of them. Again, I don't want to make it too broad, but that was my sense in the experience. And if you were somebody, as Bill was saying, you know, of an evangelical of a certain kind of cast of mind and certain belief set and value set, a lot of them have been ridiculed over the decades. That wasn't imaginary. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense that the boundaries of political discourse. You couldn't say certain things or register certain opposition to cultural trends without being assaulted as illiberal, fundamentally illiberal. And Trump blew that. Of course, from my perspective, it was that he blew it apart so far and that there were no longer any boundaries, that he crossed boundaries that are quite problematic. But I think that's what occurred.
Okay. Did you both finish answering James' question?
Best I could.
Yeah. That's good. Okay, then Miranda Kennedy is up next, and then Eugene Scott and Mark, and that'll take us into the lunch. Those three. So, Miranda?
Now, this is just actually an answer to the question.
Push
it's
the
on.
Okay.
Let me just take a moment. In answer to the previous question about whether we have more data about self-described evangelical voters other than that they go to church once a week, I wonder whether you guys, what you think of that Barna 9-point survey, have you seen that? Like a decade ago they came up with this, and I'm just interested what you think, because it says, so if you fill out this 9-point survey as a self-described evangelical, if you don't hit any of the points, it's 38% of Americans would call themselves evangelical. And once, if you fill all 9 points, then it's narrowed down to about 8% of the population. So I wonder whether there was any effort on their part or on anyone else's part to apply that kind of narrowing, and whether that would help us understand the number of religious voters who were voting on religious reasons rather than on identity politics reasons.
I just don't know the Barna data well enough to comment on it, but I think that there should be more work out there, and there probably is privately, but that we don't see publicly at all on this very question. But
Because they asked like very, very specific questions about like whether, you know,
doctrinal questions.
Yeah, doctrinal questions. Exactly. So and about the role of God and faith in your life, and I think that radically reduces the number of people who self-describe as an evangelical. That seems really significant, doesn't it?
On the face of it, yes. And I read about that survey when it came out almost a decade ago, but I certainly don't have the details firmly enough in mind. But it underscores the point, which is related to the question that Ken Woodward asked, about the gross categories versus more fine-grained inquiry. And I think in this morning we've identified a range of questions that could well use more fine-grained qualitative as well as quantitative inquiry. So we have a lot more questions than answers this morning, you probably noticed.
Okay, our final two speakers are on this side over here, Eugene Scott and then Mark, and then we're going to have a short announcement, and then we're going to break for lunch. Eugene, over here, you got the mic?
Yeah. Yes. So I've seen quite a bit of conversation among journalists throughout the election about how evangelicals, what we're seeing the data support, just differs from what we have historically known or believed evangelicals to be, which would lead me to believe maybe we need to redefine our idea of what an evangelical is. And I think for one of the first times we saw during this election conversations about the diversity of evangelicalism. So it's worth noting that Black and Latinos who historically do not refer to themselves as evangelicals, but who hold many of the same convictions as traditional evangelicals, overwhelmingly did not support Donald Trump. And the same with many millennial evangelicals. And so in addition to the concept of nominal evangelicals, which we haven't, I don't think, historically used, perhaps we have to go back to figuring out what we believe evangelical is, and maybe in our reporting explain what types of evangelicals we're actually talking about when we're writing about evangelicals. Have you seen any data looking at how the faith evangelicalism is just different from what we historically have thought it to be?
As Bill said to the last question, we need a lot more fine-grained research, and I think that, you know, the exit poll is a single piece of paper with a bunch of questions on one side and a bunch of questions on the back. And they fight every year over what questions are going to be in there. They drop some really important questions, it seems, every 4. I'm not even sure the exit poll is going to be around in another 4 years. I think it's going to change in some significant ways, but it's. I think we do need to change the white evangelical board again question in the poll. I think everybody realized that after this campaign. It's such a, you know, I've used this word before, it's such a blunt instrument, and we use it because we could go back and look at historical data over time, and that's what it's valuable for overall, but it leaves a lot out, and I think that we need to rethink some of these definitions.
Exactly right.
Okay, Mark, pull the mic over. You got to pull that microphone over. Just pull it over. You can lift it up.
Lift the whole thing up.
Put it right in front of your mouth.
Crazy.
And turn it on.
I think so.
Okay.
To what extent, or do you have data on, was being in a union household more important than being religious? The evidence suggests that unionization counts for less and less today. Take Westmoreland County in western Pennsylvania, which I wrote about in this great book that came out in 2007 that my name is attached to, called Why Democrats Are Blue. In the 1990s, Hillary Clinton's husband carried the county twice, and in 2016, she lost the county by 47,000 votes, 59,000 votes for her to 116,000 votes for Donald Trump, and she lost the whole state of Pennsylvania by 44,000 votes. So it was often said that Pennsylvania, or Philadelphia, was the big county in Pennsylvania, but it seems like West areas that were that have become deunionized have, at least in this election, were important. So
yeah, I think that one. Both of you think that. You have some data on that?
Carlin,
I'm still looking for data.
She's looking for data, and so I've actually drilled down into Pennsylvania. But let me begin with a datum that I think has been underemphasized, and that is that Hillary Clinton's share of the white Catholic vote was lower than it has been for Democratic presidential candidate for a very long time. She substantially or significantly underperformed Barack Obama 2012 among white Catholics, and Obama 2012 had already significantly underperformed Obama 2008 among white Catholics. Now, I mention this because if you look at Pennsylvania, you know, white Catholics in small town and rural areas are thick on the ground. And here's what happened in Pennsylvania, and most people, I think, don't understand this. Hillary Clinton did as well as Barack Obama 2012 did in Allegheny County, a.k.a. Pittsburgh. She did almost as well in Philadelphia. She did better than Obama 2012 in the suburban collar counties around Philadelphia. She ended up with 60,000 more votes in Pennsylvania than Barack Obama 2012 got. What happened? Trump mobilized 300,000 new voters into the system, you know, into the Pennsylvania electorate, than Romney had, you know, to vote for a Republican candidate. 300,000. That sea of red surrounding Pittsburgh and the Philadelphia area, almost all those counties have been red in 2012. That's not the point. The point is the turnout. Point is the margins, and the turnout was very, very strong. And this is part of a more general pattern about the 2016 election. Most people believe it was a low turnout election. Wrong. Most people believe the turnout will end up to be roughly equivalent to 2012. Most people believe that Democrats didn't turn out to vote for Hillary Clinton. Wrong. When all the votes are counted, she will probably have slightly more votes than Barack Obama got in 2012. The difference is that Donald Trump is going to end up with about 2.5 million more votes than Mitt Romney got in all the right places, like Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, my question is, to what extent is just in Westmoreland County, when I was talking to voters in 2003 and 2004, we talked to white voters.
Yeah.
As in members of my extended family.
Right.
They'll say, well, yes, I'm religious, but I'm a member of a union household, and that's most important to me. Keeping my job is most important. Right. And maybe this evidence suggests, but again, maybe it's wrong, that in places like Westmoreland County, that you have fewer union members, and maybe unionization is not as important a factor as it was 12 years ago.
It can't be, because the economic base that supported the union movement is a whole lot weaker than it was 12 years ago. So those two things go together. You can't have unions if you don't have steel plants. Can't have unions if you don't have coal mines. Right. And if those sorts of industries are going down the tubes, then the union base is, and a lot of the people who used to have a sense of solidaristic participation in the union, which was seen as fighting for them, well, they're on their own now, which is why they're looking for a strong man to help them, because the collective, the collective instruments that they used to have to defend them and to advance their interests have weakened or disappeared altogether. So, yeah.
Carlin has some data for us.
Union households were, or at least people answered the question, does anyone in your household belong to a labor union? 18% of voters said someone did, and they voted 51% to 43% for Clinton. White evangelical vote was 26%, so it was a smaller share.
Ladies and gentlemen, the word evangelical has come up a lot here today, and we have in the House one of the leading American historians of American evangelicalism who's going to be in our next session. That would be Dr. Grant Wacker. So, Grant, this has given you some thought to add to maybe some of your comments, but please join me in thanking both of our speakers. We're back in here at 1 o'clock for our next session. Lunch will be right where we had breakfast, right out the door here, so please join us for lunch.
Perfect.